evening and welcome. My name is Dure Dara, and as the convener of the Victorian Women's Trust, it's my pleasure to welcome you, to say thank you for thinking to come and spend time auditing the great occasion to mark the 50th year since the pill was introduced into Australia. I was 16 years old, and it helped me in some way and troubled me in others. So I would like to say that this is a wonderful way to audit 50 years of the pill by bringing scholarship together with wisdom and shared experience. It's always our opportunity in the public platform to remind ourselves that we are privileged to live in Australia. And with this opportunity, it's important to pay respects to the elders and leaders of the First Nation people who have given us the privilege of a living culture. And it's for them to forgive and for us to always remember. So I would like to pay my respects to the elders and leaders of the Wurundjeri people on the land in which we stand, and to the elders and leaders of all communities in Australia, including the elders and leaders of our community of feminist women who want to sit together and listen and think and talk. I'll leave the rest of the evening to others, but thank you, Melbourne University Centre for Women's Health, Gender and Society. What a name. It's wonderful to have partnership with your scholarship. So thank you, and let's proceed. Thank you for being here.
Can you join me, please, in thanking Dure again for that welcome? Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I think there are a couple of gentlemen. Maybe give you a shout out to you. I could just chat to you this evening if you like, just sitting there by yourself. You all right? Yeah, you're going to learn some stuff tonight, fella. Don't worry about that. Welcome to the 50th anniversary of the pill in Australia, an incomplete revolution. Ladies and gentlemen, my name's Nellie Thomas. I'm going to be your MC for this evening. I would again like to thank Dure for that welcome. I too would like to acknowledge the traditional owners and pay my respects to elders past and present. There are a number of distinguished guests here tonight. I'd like to offer a special welcome to them. I'd also like to welcome undistinguished guests. You lot tend to be more fun, you're kind of more my people. If I can, I'll just do a bit of housekeeping to start off. Can you please, out of respect to the speakers you're going to see this evening, turn off your mobile phone or put it on silent? Thank you very much, reaching for your bags. Just to let you know, for those of you who haven't seen the program, we're going to have three wonderful speakers to entertain you and inform you and incite you, hopefully, tonight, as well as a panel at the end where you'll get to ask questions. I do like to run a tight ship. I know I've seen some of you at events previously. We will be finishing at 7:30 on the dot so we can go home and watch Celebrity Apprentice. Just me and him. I also like to do my thanks up front. I know it's traditionally done at the end, but I like to do it while you still care. So if I can, I'd like to start by thanking the director and staff of the Centre of Women's Health Gender Society at the University of Melbourne, as well as the executive director and staff at the Victorian Women's Trust. You can imagine what a massive amount of work has gone into this event, so please thank them warmly. I'd also like to offer special thanks to Caitlin Davies and Women's Trust, who's a volunteer, Caitlin, and Women's Trust staff member Alison Oliver-Perman for her design work on and presentation on a booklet that you'll receive on your way out in a little show bag, like the Royal Show, but more fun. I went this year, let's never speak of it again. So please do take a look at it, because a lot of work has gone into the booklet and there's fabulous and amazing information in there. On that note, there's a number of sponsors who've contributed items to your little show bag. I won't thank them all, but needless to say, we appreciate your support. If you give them a round of applause as well, please. Excellent. Thank you. So obviously we are here tonight to celebrate, mark, acknowledge, or all three, the 50th anniversary of the pill. As I've said, you'll hear from some very distinguished speakers tonight, a lot with doctor in their title, but I'm a comedian, so I must warn you, my job is to tell you that parts of the night could get rude. Okay, we're talking about doing it. Like totally, like rooting. Let's just get that out. Not rooting, doing it, not doing it, getting on, getting it off, bumping uglies. As the young people say, tapping that. I don't know why, but I can tell you that's what they say. Yes, we are a bunch of feminists who are going to be talking about sex, so Andrew Bolt, sharpen your pencil. Now, I pretty much talk about sex for a living, but I do understand that it is an uncomfortable subject for some. My mum, for example, avoided the subject altogether. She had a bit of a don't ask, don't tell policy when it came to sex. So I actually learned about sex from Dr. Feelgood. Now, you remember Dr. Feelgood, Sally Coben? Yeah, fantastic. And I ended up very good at sex, so well done to her, just saying. In mum's defence, I guess it would have been quite difficult to tell me about sex when the only word she knew for vagina was woohoo. Then again, my nana referred to it as a so get those two going, like woohoo. Yeah, less the birds and the bees and more just bird calls. Yeah. Told me everything I needed to know. I will introduce our first speaker in a moment, but I'll just set the scene a little bit and provide a bit of context. So the 1960s, the pill was invented. The changes between now and then are obviously both small and large. The most obvious changes are technological. You know, forget iPhones and Twitter and Dr. Lewin's private formula, which is neither a formula or private. I've never understood that. Your mums wouldn't have had those. In fact, most of your mums would have grown up without a TV. Some people have just literally been shocked to the core. When I was young, we only had one TV. It was in the lounge room, and it only played F Troop and the Sullivans. And that's all we needed, damn it. And a country practice, obviously. The good old days were country practice. Actually, my mum had a day off when Molly died. Fact. She did. Oh, that was sad. It was. Let's pay her that. The changes between now and then are obviously social as well. Your mum's home was probably structured along very traditional gender lines. The shed was his, the kitchen was hers, and she did all the ironing. I know, it's shocking for the youngsters here, it really is. People used to iron. Mental. Men were supposed to look and dress and act like men, and women were supposed to look and dress and act like Crystal Carrington. Your mum almost certainly wore dresses and skirts and would have had pubes. I'll just let you take that in. She would have. I'm not even joking. Ask her about it when you get home. Houses back then cost about $5. Cars were $3.50. They're not necessarily accurate figures, so I wouldn't quote them. And Grandma lived with you until she carked it in her 70s. For recreation, people talked, had sex, and smoked inside. Oh. Maybe they were the good old days. The oral contraceptive pill was only available for married women, so single mothers were shunned by everyone in town, shipped off to Auntie Edna's for 9 months and had their kids stolen from them. Theoretically, I suppose heterosexual women could choose not to have sex, but let's face it, women were hornbags even in the olden days. The dreams and aspirations of my mother and grandmothers were shaped by their time and context. I had my first child at 34. My nana, who was born well before the pill was invented, had 12 children by the time she was 38. I know, 12 kids out of her, woohoo! Really, you'd think she'd earn the right to call it a vagina. Yeah, really. Actually, Nana did say to me once in a rare conversation we had about sex, she said, I will never forget it, I was about 15 years old, she said, Nelly, sex is a chore. You do it because you might get something in 9 months. I guess like gardening. I've never understood the pleasure in that either. And I said, Nan, but come on, you lived through the 70s. What about sexual liberation? She goes, oh, great. Now I have to pretend to enjoy that too. We didn't discuss it again, ladies and gents. The pill came too late for my nana, but it was a huge contributor to changing attitudes around sex and sexuality. Some things have improved, some things haven't as much as we'd like, but one thing is for sure, things have changed. I don't equate sex with gardening. I don't know about you people. I tell my daughter that sex is like a box of chocolates. Yeah, it's good, but you never know what you're going to get. And whatever you do, don't wait until it's only the mint creams that are left. Huh? Get in early. We're going to be talking about all that tonight. Probably not chocolates, but you and I will have that image in our minds. And on that note, I think I'll introduce our first speaker. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Louise Keogh. Louise attempts to balance an academic career with a life, often unsuccessfully. That's not my judgment. She has given me that information. She was born in the same town as Red Dog, but is nowhere near as famous or helpful. Again, don't write me the letters. All right, I've already been in a Twitter argument today. Two words, Matthew Newton, let's not discuss it. Follow me. Louise survived growing up in Perth in the 1970s and 80s, but only just. She studied chemistry at university for some unknown reason and spent three very long years working as a research chemist for a mining company before escaping to the social sciences. Dr. Louise Keogh now lives in Melbourne and feels very lucky to do so. We're very lucky to have her here this evening. Please welcome her to the stage.
Thank you, Nellie. So my take on 50 years of the contraceptive pill in Australia is as a qualitative researcher, which means I'm interested in the nitty-gritty details of how people live their lives, make decisions and negotiate with people. It's also as a sociologist, interested in individuals not just for what they tell me about themselves, but for what their stories, when you consider them together, tell us about our society. And to complicate things further, I'm a woman, a former pill user, a daughter and granddaughter of women who have told me about their fertility management in the 1970s and 1940s, respectively. And I'm the mother of a little girl who will have to face her own contraceptive decisions in the future that we deliver for her in about 10 years. Today, women contracept for a longer period than ever before in history. On average, from age 17 or 18, which is the age of first sex, to the age of about 30, which is the age of first child on average in Australia. So before having children, the average heterosexual woman will spend at least 12 to 13 years having sexual relationships with men, but not having babies. And by far the most popular methods of contraception used to achieve this long period of sexual activity prior to children are the pill and condoms. Of 16 to 29-year-olds, surveyed in Australia, 60% were using the pill, 40% condoms, so some using both, and the next most popular method after the pill and condoms in this age group was withdrawal at 5%. But let's think back momentarily to where these two popular methods came from. Firstly, condoms. They were invented to solve problems associated with sex outside of marriage, the disease risk, and the expense and social disruption caused by illegitimate children. In the 1700s, when condoms were fashioned out of pigs' intestines, they were not for use by couples having sex in relationships. And this has affected how we see condoms today. It's still hard for women to justify carrying condoms, while for men it's a more acceptable practice. Young women see condoms as synonymous with casual relationships, and one way that young women express commitment in a relationship is often to stop using condoms and to start using the pill. So, condoms are great for preventing disease, especially in the case of casual sex, but they were not designed for, and nor are they really appropriate for, use in long-term committed relationships. The pill, on the other hand, was initially only available to married women. And the pill's introduction was supported by three critical social movements: the population control movement, the eugenics movement, and the feminist movement. Both eugenics and population control movements were active in the 1940s and 50s. Both movements had a similar goal: to reduce the size of families. Eugenicists believed that the poor and inferior classes should limit their family size more so than other groups, and that way in the long term we could improve the quality of the race. And this was quite an active social movement in Australia in the 1940s. The first family planning clinics were actually called racial hygiene clinics. The population control movement wasn't so fussy. They just wanted to reduce the worldwide birth rate. And in 1950, overpopulation was considered a very real and looming threat. So I think the American Public Health Association called it the biggest issue facing the world in 1950. Feminists had for different reasons been advocates for fertility control since the early 1900s. These first wave feminists were active in the early 1900s and were the first to respond to the devastating effects of repeated childbearing and high rates of maternal and infant mortality on women. They fought for the right to give women fertility control advice and often set up their own clinics in big cities like London and New York, and often went to jail for doing so. But in the 1940s and 50s, the activism shifted to fighting for a more reliable, woman-controlled contraception, because really all they could tell women prior to that was about rhythm method and withdrawal and douches and things that were not very effective. So the shift really was made towards, let's find something that's going to work better for women. And there were two women in particular in the 1950s, Margaret Sanger and Catherine McCormick, who funded and encouraged scientists who were actually working on infertility treatments, which was quite legitimate at that time. They funded them to work on contraceptives rather than infertility treatments. There was strong opposition from the Catholic Church, and so the scientific work was actually conducted in secret right up until the last moment. And the first application to have the pill licensed described it as a drug that would cure menstrual abnormality. But within a year, another application was made, and this time it was referred to as a drug that would act as a contraceptive agent. And in this same year, in 1961, the pill was approved for use by married women in Australia. So the pill was designed to allow women to have more control over the gap between their children and the final number of children they had. When my mother went to get it in 1969, she had to don a wedding ring and give a fake address to the doctor. The pill is a hormonal treatment that changes the lining of the uterus and prevents ovulation in order to prevent conception. But the inventors were aware that the Catholic Church were very opposed to any interference with fertility, and so the pill is actually designed in a very specific way, which was all about getting the Catholic Church on side. The reason there are 21 days of active pills and 7 days of inactive pills is to induce what is called a withdrawal bleed, which is actually not a period, but by doing this, they were arguing that the pill was just mimicking women's normal menstrual cycle, and therefore it should be acceptable as a natural drug. But we know that the Catholic Church were not convinced, but nonetheless, many women today will still be on a pill that has this artificial 28-day cycle for no other reason than that was what was thought would convince the Catholic Church. So, great news if you're young, married in the 1960s. For the first time, you can scientifically delay the birth of your children, have a longer space between children if desired, and without any interference with the sexual experience. And inevitably, the birth rate did continue to fall, so it did its job that it was designed to do. The 60s and 70s were also a time of great social activism and change. And the social changes that occurred at this time are referred to as the sexual revolution. These changes are not unrelated to the pill, but they're not solely due to the pill either. They're often conflated, but they're two quite different things. I'm going to talk about two of the changes from the sexual revolution. One of them was a change to the sexual double standard. Up until this time, it was socially acceptable for men to have sex and enjoy it, but women were meant to be pure and virginal until marriage, and in general, were expected to uphold morality on behalf of society. So that sexual double standard was begun to be eroded at this time and has continued to be. Another change made at this time was relaxing the social and legal sanctions of portraying sexual images in public. So before 1960, you weren't allowed to say the word contraception on radio. The 60s and 70s were a time of liberation for women, for sex, for homosexuality, and for pornography. But let's be clear, women and men had been managing fertility well before 1960, but just not in ways that were considered scientific, and not without interfering with the sexual experience. The big demographic transition actually occurred in the early 1900s, when the average family size went from 7 babies per family to 4, which was between the late 1800s and the early 1900s. This was pre-pill, without any real increase in the use of condoms, and demographers have suggested that it was withdrawal, abstinence, and the rhythm method that played a role in this transition that occurred at this time. So the pill didn't start contraception in marriage, but it did give it a makeover. Contraception became scientific, medical, and was no longer about messy, embarrassing things like withdrawal and abstinence, or even diaphragms and condoms. So now you could go to the doctor, display your wedding ring, and ask for pills to prevent conception. And the sexual revolution meant that soon after being available to married women, the pill also became available to unmarried women in the 1970s in Australia. So in 10 short years, the social sanctions of sex outside of marriage changed dramatically. In time, sex outside of marriage became the norm in Australia and elsewhere. So let's fast forward to the early 2000s. We know that compared to the 40s and 50s, women have sex earlier and have babies later. Marriage occurs later, if at all. And for many years, women are having sex with men without the safety net of marriage for the times that methods fail and pregnancy occurs. Yet women are still mostly relying on pills and condoms. A small proportion still use traditional methods, and an even smaller proportion use the newer hormonal delivery methods like injections and implants that have been the only really new contraceptives that have been introduced since the pill. And male and female sterilisation are popular after families are completed. So for short, I refer to the approach to fertility management prior to 1960s as the social control of fertility, because it was mainly through not having sex before marriage, which is a social convention and had social consequences. If you didn't do that, there would be severe consequences for you and your family. That was how fertility was controlled. And when I asked my grandmother about her fertility management, she talked of things like restraint and being careful, keeping out of trouble. And she knew that as a woman, it was her responsibility to ensure that sex didn't occur before marriage, and she was very invested in achieving that. However, in 1960, the management of fertility began to be achieved through technological means. So I refer to the approach taken after this time as the technological control of fertility. Sex became progressively more acceptable outside of marriage, and fertility management was achieved through contraception rather than policing sexual behaviour. So how does the technological control of fertility work for young women today? In the course of my PhD research, I interviewed 32 women who had recently used emergency contraception. A disruptive experience like this is thought to be a good time to get women to reflect on their choices, their experience, and how they tackle the problems they face with contraception. The women I spoke to were aged between 18 and 45, and they were in a range of relationships. So some were casual, some were in an early part of a relationship, and some were in established relationships and marriages. And they were all attempting to manage the needs of their sexual body and their fertile body. We often hear the rhetoric that since the sexual revolution and the introduction of the pill, sex has been freed from reproduction. I don't know about you, but for me, this idea creates an image of sex existing in a whole different compartment of our lives to fertility. And this was not what I found. It was not that sex was not fun and an important part of relationships and lives, it mostly was, but the idea of their fertility, both their current fertility and their future potential fertility, were ever present in women's thinking, planning and decision making. And when women described the types of decisions they'd made, they were really describing the ways they dealt with this conflict between the needs of their sexual body and the needs of their fertile body. Some women chose to take the pill in the present to allow sex without interference, and very often these women harboured concerns about their fertility. They asked themselves, well, if the pill stops ovulation, is it doing damage to my fertility? Is it natural? Will I be able to fall pregnant when I want to later? And even though they were prioritising their sexual body and the ability to have sex without concerns about their fertility, it didn't mean they were able to completely silence this fertile body or that it went away. It was still this sort of low-level concern for them. There was also a smaller group whose preferred method was the pill, but who were unable to take it for many reasons. And this is not surprising, as 16% of women have got contraindications to taking the pill. So the types of reasons that women described to me were things like the pill causing depression, migraines, continual use being precluded by a disease like endometriosis, which means you have to take the pill and then stop and then take it, or even the irregular hours of shift work meant for some women taking a pill every day just wasn't feasible. But as they were unable to adopt this ideal strategy, they were forced to compromise their sexual body, because really once you remove the pill out of the picture, there's not really much left. It's really down to condoms, diaphragms, IUDs. An 18-year-old Skye summarised it pretty well. She was forced to rely on condoms, which was not her preference, and she just said, they hurt sometimes and they rub. And I think it sums up really well what it would be like to be using condoms all the time. They're not an ideal strategy, but there's many women who can't use the pill, and it's really all they're left with. So So it's important to note that once, yeah, because all of the newer methods are still delivering the same hormones just through a different delivery device, either an implant or an injection. So there was a group of women in my study who felt so strongly about their fertile body being free from interference that they used only methods that they saw as not affecting their fertility. And this group chose to use condoms, the rhythm method, or diaphragms. These methods interfere more with the sexual body, so condoms you have to put on halfway through sex, and using the rhythm method means you can't have sex for a few days of every month. But these women were choosing actively to interfere with their sexual body in order to preserve their fertile body and protect it for the future, and that was how they made their decisions. And there were only two women who hadn't found a way to manage their fertility that was satisfactory for them. One had fallen pregnant twice on the pill, and it wasn't because she'd missed a pill, she was taking it appropriately, and her husband refused to wear a condom. So she really had no option for contraception, and she was hoping to sort something out, but for her, she hadn't found a strategy. There was another woman who liked occasional casual sex, but she couldn't bring herself to ask casual partners to use condoms. She just found it too embarrassing. So she really didn't have a strategy because she didn't want to go on the pill. She was only having very rare sex, maybe once or twice a year, but she just found it really hard to ask. So her plan was abstinence, but she wasn't confident that she'd be able to stick to it. So the women that I spoke to were not experiencing their sexual body as something separate from their fertile body, and they described negotiating these two bodies as an act of compromise, and nobody really described a perfect strategy. When they were having sex and they didn't want to fall pregnant, all women felt that they were taking some risks, whether it was the risk of an unplanned pregnancy or the risk that their fertility or their body or their mood would be compromised by a long period on the pill. They all felt that there was some risk that they were taking, no matter what decision they made. And in terms of their concerns about fertility and their fertile bodies, I think the repeated news stories that we see, things like women's fertility begins falling from age 25 and women only have a finite supply of eggs and alarmingly low Australian birth rate, probably don't help women to feel confident about their fertile bodies. And why would women feel that there was a risk-free option? Even if a woman chooses to take the pill and use condoms when she's at risk of an STI, she could still end up with an unplanned pregnancy. The pill has a failure rate of 9% in the real world, and the condoms have a failure rate of 14%. Recent estimates predict that in an average lifetime, each woman will have two contraceptive failures. Given these figures, is it that surprising that one in three women are still having an abortion in their lifetime in Australia? But back to what women said. It was not only the sexual and the fertile bodies that women took into account in their contraceptive decisions. It was a whole raft of other social things that influenced their decision making. They took into account what was normal. So women would say, I'll only use the normal contraceptives, which meant the pill and condoms. So anything outside of that was seen as strange and other. Also what was natural and varied for women. So some women would say, I don't want to be on the pill because it's not natural. But other women would say, well, for me, if I have a regular 28-day cycle, then that feels natural and that I achieve that on the pill. So it wasn't that the pill was always seen as unnatural, but this idea of natural was really pervasive and most women wanted to feel like they were doing something that was natural for them. They also had to deal with gendered expectations of sex and fertility. Few men take more than a passing interest in their partner's contraception. And gendered roles were especially noticeable in the casual encounters. So often women in relationships would talk about how, yeah, they would talk about it with their partner and it would be a joint decision. But male casual sex partners would rarely mention contraception. There was one notable exception who said halfway through the act, "I hope you're on the pill." She wasn't, but she didn't tell him that. She figured it was her responsibility and she took herself off to get emergency contraception the next day. On top of these concerns, women are also aware that contraceptives are manufactured and distributed by companies that operate to make a profit. So women didn't have a great deal of trust that pharmaceutical companies would always have their best interests at heart. And another thing that impacted on women's decisions was life stage. The women I spoke to were at four different life stages. I've called them the early sexual life stage, a more responsible sexual life stage, an early fertile life stage, and then a renewed sexual life stage. And I'll just talk a little bit about each. Young women in the early sexual life stage were usually in a first relationship or first sex. and were much more likely to prioritise their sexual body. Their fertility was a long way off in the future. They didn't really think about it, and then they all said, if I fell pregnant, I would definitely have an abortion. And they didn't feel like there would be a lot of judgment from society if they had an abortion because they were young and they were just embarking on their sexual career. So they felt they had some freedom and some leeway around making mistakes. Whereas women then moved into the responsible sexual life stage, they were closer to what we call childbearing age, so mid-20s to mid-30s, and they were much more concerned about their fertile body. So they all expressed this concern about, will I be able to fall pregnant and what will my contraceptive decisions affect it? They talked about having more personal responsibility for their behaviour. So they felt if they got pregnant, they probably would have to have the baby as they got older. So Maria was 26 and she said, if at this stage of my life, at 26, if I was to fall pregnant, I have to deal with it. I have no excuse really. Made my bed, got to lie in it. Which was not what the younger women said. They all said, oh, abortion straight away. I'm not in a position to have a baby. So even though Maria didn't want a baby, she felt like she would have to deal with it because she was of this childbearing age. The next stage was the early fertile life stage, when young women felt they had satisfied their own criteria for having a family. And for women, the criteria for having a family are financial, emotional, career, relationship criteria. Some even throw in, you know, world travel before they have children. There's a whole raft of things that women define they need to do before they can have children. But once they decided they were in that life stage and that they were thinking about having children, they wanted to time it, well, the women in my study wanted to time it down to the month of the year that they wanted to fall pregnant. So one woman used emergency contraception in November because she wanted to have a drink over Christmas and have an overseas trip and fall pregnant in February. So they're very interested in timing pregnancy, and this idea that we can time pregnancy is very prevalent amongst women. But once women's childbearing is completed and children are older, they enter what the women in my study have called the renewed sexual biography. They go back to being less worried about fertility and happy to use more invasive contraceptives and happy to consider abortion again for unplanned pregnancies, whereas the two middle life stages didn't feel comfortable about that. So several women in my study had come out of long-term marriages and had teenage children, and they had little interest in preserving their fertility. They felt empowered to make decisions based on their own sexual needs rather than their fertile needs. So to summarise the features of the women I interviewed, I've described them as reflexive women. They had to be reflexive in order to manage competing demands of their sexual and fertile body and all of the other factors, the social factors that I've talked about. So the reflexive woman strategically controls risk, she plans pregnancy, and she manages crises. This is in stark contrast to the reckless woman who is often portrayed in the medical literature when you start to look at research around emergency contraception and abortion. The literature often stereotypes these women as risk-taking and creating their own crises, whereas that was not the women that I spoke to. So I put to you that the reflexive woman is a better representation of women who are attempting to have sex and manage fertility today. And if this reflexive woman is how we propose to think about women, what does her existence and the things she's doing and facing tell us about our society? Our society presents us with a number of contradictions that are unarticulated, yet women are expected to manage these contradictions through their day-to-day lives and decision-making. And there are three main contradictions that I'm going to take you through. The first is we expect to separate sex and fertility, but we don't have a reversible contraceptive that's 100% effective. We expect a level of gender equality, but in reality, as a society, we haven't achieved that. We expect to be able to time pregnancy to fit in with our other life goals, but we know that one in five women will struggle to fall pregnant at the time she chooses. So the sexual revolution has shifted our expectations, but reality has not shifted in time with our expectations. So as a result of the sexual revolution, we expect to separate sex and fertility, but in reality, it's difficult to do. But rather than demanding a method that does what we want, we keep quiet about our contraceptive failures, and for one in three of us, keep quiet about the fact that we've had an abortion. We think we should be more responsible, more compliant with the pill, more forthful with our sexual partners to get the contraception that we want, and more deliberate in our thinking and planning about sex. This came up a lot in my interviews. You know, I really should have thought it through better. What was I doing having sex when I didn't have condoms handy? And But in reality, no contraceptive is 100% effective. So why don't we expect contraceptive failure and abortion as part of our lives? And as a result of the sexual revolution, we expect a level of gender equality. Because the sexual double standard no longer exists, right? And men take responsibility for contraception as much as women do, right? Fertility management is a joint decision. Male partners of women having abortions are considered just as responsible as the female undergoing the abortion, right? But the problem, I think, is not that we don't have gender equality. That does suck. But what is even worse, that we don't call it what it is. We think it's just our relationship. It's our inability to communicate, to negotiate, to make it work, that leads us into situations where we don't have the power or control that we would like. Instead, we should be looking outwards and saying, why don't we yet have gender equality? And start demanding some answers. The last contradiction is that we think we can time pregnancy to fit in with our life goals. But 1 in 2 pregnancies are unplanned. 1 in 5 women have trouble conceiving at the time they choose. Do we march in the streets demanding a solution? No, because we think it's just us. We've been too slow to settle down, too indecisive, too picky about partners. How often do you read that in the newspaper, despite the fact that we know that's not the reason women delay childbirth? We still have remarkably poor control over the timing of pregnancy. And the tools we use to extend our childbearing years, IVF, are costly and physically and emotionally demanding. So why do we act like we have control when in reality, many of us will not be able to squeeze pregnancy into the narrow bands of time we're offered to do so? When we solve these 3 contradictions, when they're articulated to women, understood by society, then resolved to the satisfaction of both men and women, then the revolution will be closer to completion.
Thank you, Louise.
Actually, Louise, I'll ask you a quick question. Did you, any of the women you interviewed, think the pill made them fat? Yeah, because I hear that a lot. I think so does pregnancy. quite a lot fatter. Anywho, our next speaker I'm very excited to introduce. She always challenges and inspires. Dr. Leslie Canold has been noted as one of Australia's top 20 public intellectuals, and in 2011 she was honoured as Australian Humanist of the Year. Her latest book is a historical novel, The Book of Rachel, and the 2 previous non-fiction ones, The Abortion Myth and What, No Baby, canvass female freedom to have and avoid having children. Leslie grew up in New York with a quasi-feminist mother, again, not my words, quasi, hers, a father who liked to talk about the importance of being able to look at yourself in the mirror, and a bookshelf that was never without a battered copy of Our Bodies, Ourselves. She sees these facts as explaining her seeming permanent irascibility on matters to do with sex, conflicts of interest, and fertility control. Please join me in welcoming the fabulous Dr. Leslie Canold.
Hello, good to see you all tonight. I need to start the timer because I've been told that basically death will await me if I go over time. So just hang in there. Right, okay, my 18 minutes starts now. So anyway, usually when you start a public speaking gig, what you're always told to do is tell a joke, but I actually don't really have time, so let's take it as read that I've just told you a completely hilarious joke. You have laughed your heads off, and you are now feeling warm and kindly towards me, and I can move on. So where I'm going to move on to is I want to tell you a story. The story I want to tell you is about a letter I got in the lead up to the preparations for the 50th anniversary of the pill in Australia, which, as many of you now already know, was 1961. So 50 years is our anniversary this year. 50 years was actually the anniversary, is that better? The anniversary in the United States. So in the lead up to the preparations for the marketing blitz that was going to happen in the 50th anniversary here in Australia, I got a letter as the president of Reproductive Choice Australia. So it was addressed to me, and it was talked about, it was from the Bayer Sharing Pharma business unit. And it asked, it talked about, it had a whole bunch of sort of quotes in it, so I'll just give you some of the quotes that were in the letter. It talked about the pill and how it was an important milestone in women's healthcare. It talked about entering into a dialogue of collaboration with my organization to celebrate this wonderful and momentous event. It talked about the proud heritage of the pharmaceutical company and the current practice of providing women with reliable and trusted contraceptive options. And it went on and really gave you a warm and fuzzy, glowing sort of feeling. But if any of you kind of know me, you know that probably I was the wrong lady to get this letter. So I decided that I wanted to ring up the marketing unit and just ask them some questions about this dialogue of collaboration that they were proposing with my organization. So my organization is Reproductive Choice Australia. It's a teeny weeny weeny little grassroots community-based organization. We have absolutely no money. We barely exist on the planet. We only came into existence because Tony Abbott became the health minister. And indeed, we will probably only reignite and become another fighting force if, God forbid, Tony Abbott becomes the prime minister. So we're really a speck in the reproductive landscape. So I really wanted to know what a dialogue of collaboration with us exactly would mean. So I rang up the marketing unit and I tried to get in touch with the woman who was at the bottom of the letter, and indeed I did. And I told her that I was ringing up to begin a dialogue of collaboration and wondered what that was going to be like. And she, you know, at first was really excited because most people presumably don't actually, when they get this letter, go, oh my God, how exciting, and I can't wait to start a dialogue of collaboration with Bear Sharing, and ring straight away. But soon she started to realize that perhaps, you know, this wasn't going to be as good as she thought, because what I really wanted to know was what they were actually planning to do in terms of the kinds of aims and interests of my organization to do the sort of things they were talking about. So how were they going to, you know, advance women's health care and all of that sort of thing? And actually I had an idea, because she was, you know, stuttering and coming up with blanks. And I said, I actually have an idea. Wouldn't it be fabulous if Bear Sharing actually endowed a lecture, a yearly lecture, where every year we could actually get a fantastic speaker to come and talk about women's health care and talk about providing women with reliable and trusted contraceptive options and other health options, and talk about feminist health activism and feminist health practice and all of the things that kind of the letter was kind of alluding to and giving you the feeling about. And she said, I'll get back to you about that. And as you can imagine, I'm still waiting for that return phone call. So the marketing blitz began as expected. We weren't involved as expected. And I guess, you know, what happened was I was just noticing more and more things that were kind of irritating me, in the same sense that that letter had really irritated me, because the letter was really, in some ways, like I said, trying to kind of capture that good, warm, glowy sort of feeling that you rightly get when you think about feminist health practice and feminist health activism. And it was in some ways trying to utilize the credibility and the stature of organizations that really are engaged in that kind of work, the kind of trust that they have with women, because they're not trying to sell women anything. They're actually just trying to, well, for instance, in the case of my organization, we really are just trying to advocate for a legal and a provision situation so that women can actually, if they want to, be able to choose abortion if that's in their interest. We're not selling abortion, we're not selling any product, we're actually really just trying to provide an environment in which women can make that decision. So of course we would have the trust of women insofar as that trust is available, because of exactly that. And in some ways what I felt was that the pharmaceutical company was trying to kind of capitalize on that by using the language and the discourse of feminist health activism in order to sell a product. So we would be, in some ways, kind of cashing in on our credibility in order to do something that would benefit someone else's bottom line. And I just didn't understand why we would do that. So the blitz began, and one of the things that I noticed straight away was that in some of the marketing information was reference to a study. And the study was talking about the benefits of the pill, essentially. And what it said was that women taking the pill have a lower risk of dying from any cause when compared with women who never take it. So I want to repeat that, because that's quite a claim. Women taking the pill have a lower risk of dying from any cause when compared with women who have never taken it. So I thought I'd track down that study. Now, what I found was a couple of things that were interesting, but if you know anything about pharmaceutical marketing, they won't be too surprising. One of the things I discovered was that research was partly funded by Bear Sharing. The other thing I found out was that the authors were conflicted. So the authors were receiving payments from Sharing Plough and Wyeth Pharmaceutical. I also discovered something even more interesting, which was that the conclusion of the authors was in fact this. In a relatively healthy cohort, oral contraception is not significantly associated with a major public health problem. Now, that's a pretty significant difference in terms of conclusions, isn't it? Quite significant. So, what am I annoyed about? Because as you can tell from this story, the whole thing annoyed me. So, I've already sort of said a little bit about what annoyed me. In some ways, what annoyed me was the sense that the marketing that was going on around this anniversary, which by, you know, all means needed to be commemorated. The pill has certainly been a part of the story of the journey of women's reproductive health and women's reproductive health care. But there was an attempt, I felt, with the way in which they were going about it in terms of the way it was intersecting with my organization. There was an attempt to co-opt feminist health activism and its emancipatory messages to sell product. And I really felt that that was inappropriate. And a sense, again, where we are the David in the story and they are the Goliath, and yet what they were basically asking us was for help to do some free marketing. And it's sort of like, you know, when you buy a T-shirt and then in addition to the privilege of having paid the company for the T-shirt, you then walk around as a walking advertisement with the name of the brand on it. And I never really understand why people do that, but they do it. So, you know, maybe you can't blame them for trying, but I just felt it was really inappropriate. And I felt, more importantly, that it can be really dangerous. So when you get a co-option of feminist health language, you can get confusion, because what that language signifies to women, and rightly so, if it's not colonized and co-opted, is that the people who are using it have the best interests of women and women's health in mind. They're not trying to sell a product. They're not trying to use women to serve their own interests. They are actually out there trying to provide good factual information so women can make informed choices, and that women can make choices and decisions that are in service of their own needs, not in the needs of a profit bottom line for somebody else. So when that language is co-opted, to me it feels quite dangerous, because it can be confusing, and indeed one should argue, I would imagine, that it's intended to be confusing, because it's intended to feel as though the message is coming from a place where it's about women, when in fact it's not. It's about selling product. So my irritation was also, I think, because I know a little bit too much about the pill. So it really is true that I grew up in a household where there was never not the Our Bodies, Ourselves Bible on the bookshelf. My mother bought that for me when I was quite young. In fact, I think she probably bought it for herself. And then every few years, she would buy an updated copy of Our Bodies, Ourselves. Does everybody know what Our Bodies, Ourselves is? So the older women are going, how about you younger folk? Our Bodies, Ourselves? Okay. Our Bodies, Ourselves is this big, thick, what used to be a book, it's probably now online, but it used to be this big, thick book by the Boston Women's Health Collective. And it was a book about women's bodies, women's health, written by a women's health collective from the perspective of women. It was completely, you know, 1970s, 1960s, anti-commercial, all about trying to inform women about their bodies so they could take control, get knowledge about their bodies, make active and informed decisions about their bodies, not be embarrassed, not be ashamed. And they were extremely cynical about any kind of intersection with anybody who was trying to give women information to serve other needs. They were very much trying to give women information that was honest and factual so women could make their own informed decisions about their own health based on their own their own agenda. So because if you read Our Body, Ourselves in your formative years, I think you become kind of the sort of irritable person that I became. So probably I'm warning you not to give it to your daughters. Because it was very formative for me. It really was an extremely formative kind of moment. And in it was a lot of stuff about the pill. And the stuff that was in it back then, so I was born in 65, I was probably starting to read this book in 75. The stuff about the pill back then was definitely not all very laudatory. It was concerned, and it was picking up on the concerns of somebody named Barbara Seaman, who wrote a book called The Doctor's Case Against the Pill. So again, you lot probably know about The Doctor's Case Against the Pill, yes? So Barbara Seaman was a feminist health activist, and she was the person, for instance, who led to the pill actually being the first prescription pharmaceutical that has those package inserts in it. So you know how we now take for granted that when you open up a pharmaceutical, it will have a package insert usually in it that will explain what the drug is and how you should use it and contraindications, risks and benefits. That actually came about, a lot of that came about because of Barbara Seaman's advocacy around the pill. So she wrote a book called The Doctor's Case Against the Pill. At that time, when she was very concerned about the pill contained 7 times as much estrogen as it currently does. So the new generation pills contain 7 times less estrogen than the old pills. The pharmaceutical companies were not happy about the doctor's case against the pill, and they were not happy about Barbara Seaman. So what they did was they got her fired, they got her blacklisted, and they got her censored. And probably, and again, you know, this story just hit me at a particular time in my life and given who I am, because I'm also a freelance journalist. So if all of a sudden the magazines that you submit your articles to and on whose payment you rely for your living won't publish you anymore because the pharmaceutical company is saying that if they do, they won't put ads in your magazine, that's really scary. That's really bad for you in terms of your capacity to make a living, and of course it really undermines your reputation. And that's what they did to Barbara Seaman. So I feel a little bit cynical about the whole thing too, because I do know this history about what happened when there was somebody who really was a feminist activist trying to make some important claims, factual claims, about the pill and its real implications back at that time for women's health. Now, my concerns about a lot of the stuff that goes on. So because I'm a medical ethicist, one of the areas I've become very, very interested in is the intersection between pharmaceutical companies and the creation of research. So when there's money coming in, what we used to have, so back in the good old days, we used to have funding of research that was connected, not entirely, but largely connected into the public money system. So you would get public monies for research. You'd get hired as a researcher. You'd be able to do research because that was just considered to be your job to do it. And you might have to apply for funding to get, you know, certain kind of aspects of the research dealt with. But you weren't totally reliant, as is much more the case these days, on getting money from private sector sources. So one of the big sources of research funding these days is coming from pharmaceutical companies. If you want to do medical research, that's where a lot of the funding is coming from. Now, that's kind of what I was showing you a little bit in that story, is that often what you've now got is you've got researchers who are doing research, and it's research that's telling us that certain drugs are this and certain drugs are that, and they're safe and they're not this and they're not that. They're making up a really important resource for us, which is the evidence base on which we want our doctors to be advising us about what pills we should take and what pharmaceuticals we shouldn't take and generally how we should manage our health. They're making up the resources on which, if we're, you know, very sort of eager bunnies ourselves, we can go out and actually have a look ourselves to try and make informed decisions about the pills and the pharmaceuticals we want to ingest and not ingest. So one of my concerns is that at the moment there is a lot of pharmaceutical money going into the people who are doing research. They're being funded with consultancies, they're being paid to go on, you know, conferences, and we can see very, very concrete outcomes in terms of what they're doing. So for instance, what we know is that when doctors are funded by pharmaceutical companies, say to go to a lovely conference or a resort, you know, it's a conference, but it's often, you know, the Bahamas or something, and you can take your family, and it's really, really brilliant. What we know is that the pharmaceutical companies track that. They track who's getting the benefits, and then they track how that cashes out, literally cashes out, into prescribing habits. And it works. So, of course, you know, what we often will hear when we talk about this issue is we'll hear doctors say, oh, you know, I take the pad or I take the pen or I take, you know, the benefit that comes with going to the fantastic conference or I take this or I take that, but it doesn't affect me. I'm not conflicted. I'm not affected by any of this. But, you know, there's a couple of things to say about that. One is, you know, there's what it is and there's what it looks like. And anybody who understands anything about conflict of interest understands that it's about both of those things. So even if it were the case that one could take something from someone else and not feel a normal obligation of reciprocity, and I should say that for most people, that normal feeling of you give me something, I need to give you something back, is completely the way human morality is constructed. You could arguably say that the only people who don't feel that are psychopaths. And most of us are not psychopaths, and luckily most of our doctors aren't psychopaths. So you could argue that it would be almost impossible, just in terms of the way we are constructed morally, for people not to feel that reciprocal obligation. You could argue that why in the world would it be the case that pharmaceutical companies would pay out this money if it didn't bring them some return? I think all of those arguments are completely valid, and I worry a lot about all of that sort of stuff. So we have to finish. Okay, so I will skip and I will get to the end. So what, I didn't get to say everything I wanted to say, but you get the gist. So I want to basically wind up by saying, what is it that we can conclude about the pill? So remember I talked about Barbara Seaman, the wonderful Barbara Seaman, the feminist health activist. What she died in 2008. And what she said before she died, shortly before she died, she said that if her daughters had wanted to go on the pill, she would have cried. Granddaughters. She thinks there were unanswered questions. She thinks there were unanswered questions, for instance, about the intersection between the pill and antidepressive drugs, which, as we know, many people are on. But basically, she thought it was okay. It's reliable, it's user-controlled, it's convenient. My conclusions about the involvement of Big Pharma in women's health are different. I think that the involvement skews the research agenda, and I think that that is really fundamental in terms of us being able to ever, as women, get practitioners who provide us with evidence-based advice and for us to be making informed and consensual decisions about our own health care. So I think we need to take what often sounds like a, you know, boring as batshit kind of discussion about how research is funded and understand that it's not boring as batshit. It's really, really important. We cannot have research that pursues the right questions and we can feel comfortable that it's giving us honest and complete answers unless we have research that isn't funded in a conflicted way. It isn't funded by people who have a vested interest in only certain questions being asked and certain answers coming out. So the conclusion that I want to make is that drug companies, and I know you'll be surprised about this, drug companies are not feminist organizations. Nor are they deliberate drivers of radical social innovation designed to benefit women. They are businesses seeking profits for shareholders through the creation and marketing of pills that ideally we can be persuaded to ingest every day for most of our lives. So when next time you get the kind of letter I got from Bear Sharing, don't believe the hype.
Dr. Leslie Canold, of course. Are the microphones back on?
Yeah, no.
Okay, I'll wait. Now they're back on. Excellent. Of course, Leslie never fails to provoke and to make me think, and I'm sure you as well, so you'll have an opportunity. Okay, I'm just going to yell. You'll have an opportunity to ask her questions in question time, but can you please join me again in thanking Dr. Leslie Canold? I do have to clarify one thing though, Leslie. Did you actually say on record that Tony Abbott inspired the creation of your pro-choice group? I think you did actually say. I'm conflicted about Tony Abbott myself. On the one hand, he's Tony Abbott. On the other hand, for a feminist comedian, he really is the gift that keeps on giving. So keep him around for a while, if you wouldn't mind. Our next speaker, ladies and gentlemen, is Mary Crooks. Mary Crooks has been Executive Director of the Women's Trust for 14 years. I know that she's well known to most of you. She recently returned from a long break in Italy. Oh, a bit la-di-da. I'm told her staff received weekly emails containing such gems as, yes, they have forwarded some to me and I've picked out the gems. Quote, ate only 5 gelati today. Well done, 5. Had 40 superb cappuccino coffees this week. Are you still buzzing? Lived unproblematically with 17 people in our apartment rental for weeks. Back to shared housing, excellent. Visited 311 museums and inspected 275 churches. I may have exaggerated a little bit on that one. On that note, I'll try to do my best here, Mary. Benvenuto alla fase Mary Crooks.
That is an exaggeration. But I did start my Italian class last Monday. I sat like a schoolgirl being instructed for the first time in a long time. And if you like, I could recite the 12 months of the year in Italian. No? Okay. John Rock was the developer of the pill, and he was once asked, what is the most dependable form of contraception? His answer, the same as always, 15 feet of fresh air. Women's struggle for reliable methods of contraception and birth control is surely one of the strongest but less visible threads that run through the course of human history. In your booklet that you'll be able to take away tonight, it mentions, for example, that Aristotle is cited as the first intellectual to advocate the use of contraception. In 4th century BC, he recommended the use of olive oil as a spermicidal ointment and encouraged women to anoint that part of the womb on which the seed falls. His other key recommendations included cedar oil, lead ointment, or frankincense oil. Ancient Greeks, we're told, also tried forcefully pressing the abdomen after intercourse as a way of preventing conception, and as the booklet says, good luck with that. Let's fix, though, on a more recent chronology. Bretana Smyth launched the Victorian Women's Suffrage Society in 1888 here in Melbourne. She was convinced that the most pressing inequality faced by women was overwork, economic deprivation and ill health, all caused by frequent and involuntary childbearing. She tirelessly advocated for a woman's right to advice about and access to contraception. By the early 1890s, she was writing moderately priced booklets on women's health and birth control. The large numbers of women flocking to her lectures and buying her books suggested a desire by many women for a reliable method of controlling their fertility, other than John Rock's answer about abstinence. At the time Bretana was writing and advocating for birth control, the average number of live births for Victorian women was 7. Bretana, however, was battling a deep, deep patriarchal culture. In 1897, for example, Catholic gynecologist Dr. Michael O'Sullivan, hardly a German name, in a presidential address to the Victorian branch of the British Medical Association, stated, criminal abortion, performed generally by illiterate and uncleanly charlatans of either sex, claims numberless victims and consigns them to permanent invalidism. But the most potent for evil is the prevention of conception. 10 years later, Dr. O'Sullivan warned somewhat ambiguously of the use of birth control by married couples. When a wife defiles the marriage bed with the devices and equipment of the brothel and interferes with nature's mandate by cold-blooded preventives and safeguards, when she consults her almanac and refuses to admit the approaches of her husband except at stated times, when a wife behaves in so unwifelike and unnatural a manner, can it be otherwise than that estrangements and painful suspicions of faithfulness should from time to time occur? Can a home with such an environment be a happy one? Many husbands are situated, I fear, tempted to seek elsewhere the pleasures denied them at home. Such are nature's reprisals, such indeed her unfailing retributions. That's in the Medical Society of Victoria Journal. Roughly the same time, 1904 in fact, the New South Wales government, alarmed at the declining birth rate, set up a royal commission, not surprisingly, consisted of all men and took evidence largely from men, from doctors, clergy, police and pharmacists. It concluded that women were avoiding childbearing. They were led astray by false and pernicious doctrine into the belief that personal interests and ambitions, a high standard of ease, comfort and luxury, are the essential aims in life. They are neglecting their true duty to themselves, to their fellow countrymen and to posterity. The second volume of their report, which gave details of contraceptive use and abortion, was considered so scandalous that only 12 copies were published and they were not available for distribution. They recommended licensing of maternity hospitals, restrictions on the import, distribution and advertising of abortion methods and contraceptives, and they emphasised the need for the clergy to teach moral behaviour. Post-suffrage feminists in Australia, that is, once suffrage was gained in the early 1900s, they kept up the battle for birth control and contraception, but not, importantly, to achieve sexual freedom and sexual pleasure. Their motivation was much more pragmatic, as evidenced by Rose Scott, who wrote in 1914 that women must assert the right to the control of their bodies as well as their souls, so that children of the future may have a nobler environment physically, mentally and morally before and after birth. Louise Keogh made reference to Margaret Sanger and Catherine McCormack, both of whom were advocates of birth control, backers of research into the pill. Now, in 1916, Margaret Sanger wrote in a published pamphlet, "It seems inartistic and sordid to insert a pessary or a suppository in anticipation of the sexual act. But it is far more sordid to find yourself several years later burdened down with half a dozen unwanted children, helpless, starved, shoddily clothed, dragging at your skirt, yourself a dragged-out shadow of the woman you once were." And there were several reasons why both Margaret Sanger and Catherine McCormack were so invested in the development of a new form of birth control. Margaret Sanger was one of 11 children, though her mother had experienced 18 different pregnancies. She also worked as a nurse for much of her life, during which time she served as witness to many families facing difficulty with the number of births in their family and the inability to support them. Catherine McCormack was dedicated to the movement because she feared having children with her husband due to his medical condition and its increase in severity. It is likely that he suffered schizophrenia. She feared having children who may in turn suffer similar ailments. Birth control was heavily contested terrain. And taking this terrain idea a bit further, in a wide brown land in 1942, the Coogee branch of the ALP passed a resolution stating that all birth control be banned. Their local member was called on to stop this evil canker, which is undermining our natural life, our national life, and can only lead to our extinction as a people. Post-World War II witnessed the increasing movement of women into the paid workforce, and with it, the taste of economic security and even some economic independence. The 1960s witnessed a significant increase in women, and young women in particular, taking up tertiary places, and with it, the taste of wider professional career range and a lifestyle of greater choice. And the 60s, as historian Marilyn Lake observes, feminists sought not to make men chaste, as indeed the suffrage women were arguing, but to make themselves sexually free by asserting the right to sexual pleasure without the consequences of maternity. It is in this context, cultural, economic, social, that the pill arrived in Australia in January 1961, in fact. Australia was the second country to admit it as a form of contraception. And the pill quickly became the preferred method, the method of choice for many women. Don't doubt for a minute that there was no alarmism and fear-mongering. Try as the pharmaceutical companies did to introduce their product with slick marketing, and Leslie has attested to that more recently, the perfect pack that messaged safety, security and freedom, the alarmists warned that the contraceptive pill would end civilization as we knew it, that sky would fall in, kinds of alarmism that, funnily enough, we're even seeing about carbon pricing. To me, the threat of women's increased independence, which underpinned the advent of the pill, worked a treat. And let me paraphrase that old saying, "Hell hath no fury like patriarchy scorned." Even women joined the fray. Pearl Buck, noted writer, in 1968 wrote, "It's a small object, yet its potential effect upon society may be even more devastating than the nuclear bomb." We might call that a pearler. As an historical postscript, in the first 10 days of the Whitlam government, the luxury tax, which was 27.5%, the luxury tax on contraceptives was removed, and the pill was added to the National Health Scheme. That luxury tax of 27.5% on contraceptives was equivalent to the tax on a fur coat. In retrospect, then, what do we make of the pill since its advent 50 years ago? There is no doubt in my mind it did make a huge change for many women. Certainly made a change from douches, pessaries, Condi's crystals, gin baths, and thermometers. No doubt it was and has been a significant and highly influential medical innovation. And remember, the big difference from the pill to the other alternatives was it was the first to prevent pregnancy by changing a woman's physiology. There is no doubt it reaped billions in pharmaceutical profit. There is no doubting it was a highly symbolic affirmation of women's right to control their fertility and to make reproductive choices. There's no doubt also it revealed some deep, deep double standards, and I'm not sure these have gone away. As Louise mentioned, single men were able to pursue a life of freedom, sexual freedom, all care, no responsibility, but women had to put a wedding ring on and give fake addresses in order to get a script. There is no doubt its practical contribution in the lives of many women. It certainly gave a peace of mind to women, which is much preferred to fear and desperation. It has certainly helped to avoid unwanted pregnancies, but not all. It has certainly enabled women to try a bit more successfully around the timing of pregnancies, and most certainly has helped with the numbers of pregnancies. It has given women some flexibility that they might have been able to finish a course, they might be able to start a career, they might be able to remain for periods of time in the paid workforce. And importantly, because for the younger people in the audience, you may not know the phrase shotgun wedding, which has a particular sort of brutality about it, but I think one of the practical advantages of the pill was that it gave women, in particular, more of a marriage and partner choice. They could, in fact, survey the field and not just have to marry the first one that they fell pregnant to. And I think there's no doubt that there's been a litany of negative effects, and the chemical composition of the pill has been reduced over the years, and we should bear witness and pay homage to the women from the 60s onwards who had to bear the brunt of an awful lot of side effects of the pill in order for it to become more refined for the next generations. Interestingly, and I'm not sure if she's in the audience tonight, and I won't mention her name, but someone I do know well emailed me and said, "I will be attending this landmark anniversary. Unfortunately, some of my reproductive organs won't be accompanying me due to surgery because of faulty and dangerous contraceptive treatments and techniques." The pill didn't, however, single-handedly or significantly cause or catalyse the achievement of a wider lift in women's emancipation. It acted as a wider proxy for changes, many changes that were underway anyhow. If only life and the question of gender equality was as simple as the introduction of a little white pill. Louise Keogh has demonstrated that women still manage the risk of pregnancy. They still basically have the take the responsibility and are assumed to take the responsibility of pregnancy planning. They are still largely having to deal with the moral issues and the dilemmas around contraception and abortion, and if pregnant, they have to manage the crisis as best they can, if it's a crisis. And isn't it interesting, Louise, pointing to that fact now that young women can expect to have to manage those issues under society's terms at least now on average 13 years before there might be a child. A cynic, not me, a cynic would argue that the pill has in fact been extraordinarily liberating for men. Vasectomies, despite being quick, relatively painless and effective, are still fairly low level, and the condom use of condoms is still fairly low. The idea of a vasectomy still strikes fear in the hearts of many men. We still have a high number of teenage pregnancies in this country. Women still lack in lots of respects in terms of health budgets, educational support and counselling, as do young men not seen by Tony Abbott and others, as requiring sex education and counselling. And we are in this country extremely lucky because there are hundreds of thousands of women around the globe who wouldn't have the first opportunity that we women have had over the last 50 years around access to contraceptive advice and support. Hundreds of thousands of women around the world die in pregnancy or childbirth still, and an improvement in their health status and their rights to reproductive health and choice is a pipe dream. There is no doubt that women's ability to exercise control over their reproductive system and their bodies is a key agent in the quest for equality. But there are other forces that are more critical for women to be able to live with safety, without harm, without discrimination, not in poverty, not experiencing disadvantage, and claiming their full political voice. I think, in a word, what has happened is that the pill has, over the last 50 years, helped unclasp the relationship between sex and fertility, but it hasn't unclasped the relationship between sex and power. And I think this has actually been brutally highlighted in the past year in the media in different parts of more redneck society in this country over the revelatory misogyny and sexism that has surrounded the country's first female prime minister. Women are still experiencing most of the violence across our society. Their economic security is still hampered markedly by the fact that their average superannuation balance is half what it is for men. Their unpaid work is undervalued at home. Their political representation is still low, and corporate representation on boards is, as we know, dismal. With the pill commonplace and control over one's body and reproductive rights relatively assured and relatively safe, although I think women know that we can never take for granted those rights, but if they're relatively assured and safe, the next 50 years must surely be a gearing up to catalyse the economic, the social and the political changes that are required for men and women to achieve equal rights and access to society's resources. Thank you.
Mary Crooks, everyone, for another round of applause. Thank you. Can I just clarify something, Mary? So when was the pill made available in a widespread way for women in Australia?
61.
61. And how long did you need a prescription for? Into the 70s?
Oh, easily.
Yes, easily. So if you were born between, say, before 1973, 74, you were probably in error. Just occurred to me while I was sitting up there. Thought you might want to mull over it.
Ladies and gents, now we're going to have a short Q&A session. I believe there may be a banner that needs to be put up. If anyone's going to do that, then this is the time to do it. Can I please invite our fabulous speakers back to the stage, Dr. Louise Keogh and also Dr. Leslie Cannold. And I'd also like to introduce a fourth panel member, Dr. Caitlin Davies. Dr. Caitlin Davies is currently a junior doctor at Southern Health, an aspiring obstetrician and gynaecologist, and a part-time volunteer at the Victorian Women's Trust. Her interest in this project has stemmed from growing up on a farm, having a mother who had a teenage pregnancy, going to a public primary school, a Catholic high school, medical school, and finally working in obstetrics and gynaecology. Can you please give her a special welcome since you haven't met her this evening? Can I ensure that everyone's microphones are on, please? So this is your opportunity, ladies and gentlemen, to ask questions of the panel. So if anyone has a question, if you'd like to put your hand up. Yes. If you could just wait for a microphone, please, that would be fantastic.
I'm an ex-teacher, so I've got a good, strong voice.
Okay.
I don't want to ask a question. I just want to say I'm 80 years old, and when I got married in the late 50s, before that, unless you were a married woman, you couldn't buy a contraceptive. And I don't know how many people here know that.
Thank you. You didn't have a question, just a statement? Is that right? Yeah. Question in the middle?
Thank you very much for your presentations. I'm a gynaecologist in the UK, and I've worked all my professional life in contraception. I'd slightly like to take issue with what Leslie said. The involvement of pharmaceutical companies in research is a big problem, but actually you chose quite a bad example, because the data at the 12% reduction in all-cause deaths with the pill is actually true, and it's based on a study sponsored by the Royal College of General Practitioners in the UK, which is a very robust study with very high quality data. That was just one of their statistically significant findings. But the main message is the pill is incredibly safe. It has been around for 50 years now, and we should encourage more women to be reassured. It reduces deaths from ovarian and cancer of the womb. So there's been quite a lot of negativity tonight, but the safety of the pill is one actually very robust finding. And my second point is that I think we need to turn the tables on the pill a little bit. When young girls stop using contraception, they go along to their doctors and say, I'd like to go on the pill. There are lots of other choices nowadays, and it's really important that we're upfront with discussing implants, injections, and intrauterine devices, because the pill is not a very effective method of contraception for young people, 10% failure rate, etc. So let's give women more choice to choose the method that's right for them.
We'll take the first point first, if you want to respond to that, Leslie.
Well, all I did was follow the bit that I saw the marketing in. I actually followed, because it was marketing that was coming to the age, so I actually just followed the citation. So the citation that I gave was correct. It may be that, in fact, this was found by somewhere else, but I actually followed the citation, and that is what I found. And I would stand by issues around conflict, so I think... you know, you can argue the toss on any particular area, but one of the things that I skipped in my talk was I wanted to speak quite specifically about what happened when I went to the Cochrane Collaboration. So the Cochrane Collaboration is an evidence-based resource where there's an attempt to try to sort through studies, to, you know, sort out the wheat from the chaff, try to look at really good studies and merge them together so that we can actually say something definitive. So I actually went to have a look when I was doing this bit of research for the summaries. And one of the things that I found quite startling about it is that what I would have thought a woman-centered health agenda would have as the kind of research that would be done around the pill is, sure, there would be things like, does the pill cause weight gain? And in fact, there are enough studies where they do have a summary about that. But there also is a lot of stuff where it's just comparing, you know, one pill to another. It's comparing pills, progesterone only to the the combined pills. It's looking at pills for every kind of use for acne. It's looking at hirsutism and other kinds of complications for PCOS. It's not actually what I would have thought was in the literature, where if I had wanted to look for studies around the pill, I'd want to know much more stuff about the side effect profile, and I'd want comparisons that were comparing the use of the pill for the use of contraception with other kinds of hormonal contraception. And so from my point of view, there are drivers around research agenda, and anybody who's read, for instance, Ray Moynihan's books, and I've read all of them, it's not something anyone's making up. We actually have enough data to know that pharmaceutical companies are using research and using research agendas to drive their marketing aims. And the confusion that people will often have is they think that means I don't like pharmaceutical companies, or I think pharmaceutical companies are bad and evil. I'm not saying any of that. Pharmaceutical companies are profit-driven companies. They're trying to make a profit. That's what they do. It is what it is. The question for me is a public interest question about whether or not we want a lot of our research funded by people who have a profit-driven motivation. And at the moment, some of our research is, and as a consequence, the research agenda is being skewed in the direction that's of interest to them, and certain studies are not being done, in my view, that ought to be done, and that's a concern for me.
I'll take the... I'm sorry, I can't give you an opportunity to respond. We've got too many questions.
I'm more than happy to speak to you afterwards. Yeah.
The second part of the question I'll actually give to Caitlin, if that's okay. If we can just talk about other developments in contraception. For me, if I can add the elephant in the room, for me as someone who does a lot of sex education, is STIs. Can you please address the second part of the question?
Yeah, of course. And
so can you just pull that microphone right up close to your mouth? Thanks.
So there are a few other hormonal contraceptive options, including the implants and IUDs. I guess the issues that you see with those is less desirable side effect profiles, so things with irregular bleeding that a lot of people don't find desirable. And of course, hormonal contraceptions don't do anything for STI transmission, so condoms are useful for that as well.
Thank you. Yes, down here. That's you in the red cardigan. Yeah. Oh, you're waiting for the microphone. Very good. Sorry. And I'm thinking, come on.
I just wanted to ask a question following on. Louise touched in her talk saying sort of in the vicinity of 16% of women can't take the pill and the hormones associated with that for a range of reasons, be it increased risk of stroke or whatever. And I'm just interested in the whole panel unpacking why we haven't moved beyond, you know, estrogen, progesterone, and also linked to that, the ability of a young single woman to get something like an IUD. It's still a lot of the kind of talk and advice around it is, it's for married women. So it's, in fact, you're repeating what initially happened when the pill came out, and why, you know, that kind of discourse hasn't really changed over 50
years. Can I just clarify, is that from doctors have that discourse of asking if a woman's married is asking for an IUD?
Yeah, it's
I live a sheltered life, I must. I will. Who wants to take that one, Louise? Yep.
Yeah, I was really interested actually to hear the lady from the UK in the audience talking about what they do in the UK, and they actually do give IUDs to young women. And I'm not sure, Caitlin, you may know what you're taught at medical school now. It doesn't seem to be the practice here. Is it changing in terms of what you learn about IUDs?
I think so. I guess that what we're taught generally here in Australia is that it's a lot more difficult just from a procedural point of view to insert an IUD in a woman that hasn't had children before. And that's because the cervix is less open in women who haven't had children before. And so generally the practice that seems to happen in Australia is that for women who haven't had children, that you would need a general anaesthetic to insert an IUD. And that's not general, like some people will insert them in women who haven't had babies without an anaesthetic, but that's the general sort of best practice, I guess, that we're taught. And so obviously it's a bit more difficult weighing up the risks of having an operation effectively and the risks with an anaesthetic versus other contraceptive methods.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I literally only have, I'm so sorry, we only have time for one more question. I'm sorry.
I understand that everyone's experience is quite different, but personally I had the pill, contraceptive pill, pushed on me by three or four GPs, and the idea that I wasn't going to take the pill was irresponsible. I was made to feel quite irresponsible. And sort of took the pill for about 4 years and had really horribly swollen breasts for that period, to the point where they were quite painful. And then finally saw a doctor that offered a hormone-free, very effective option, and she said, oh, you know, all of the scare around the IUD that, you know, out of marriage or a committed relationship, she said basically was, that's just fear-mongering from pharmaceutical companies. So, I mean, that's my personal experience. Do you think that is an anomaly, or does it perhaps reflect a broader trend in Australia?
Do you think, is the question that, do you think the having the pill pushed on you is an anomaly, or the experience, these negative side effects? Which part's the question?
I guess having it pushed on you.
Okay.
By GPs.
I'll give everyone a very brief go at that, and then we're going to have to wrap up.
I have not done personally research on this, but certainly there seems to be, and that has been my experience, that it is very much offered as a first line. And again, that intersects with my broader kind of point. So I'm interested in the pill just as one pharmaceutical and the way in which pharmaceuticals get into the hands of patients. Definitely one of the things we know is that doctors get a lot of their education from pharmaceutical representatives, and so they're much more likely, if they've had an intersection with a pharmaceutical representative, to prescribe that pill and to prescribe a particular, not just a particular drug, but a particular brand of a drug. And that's, of course, the aim of the pharmaceutical representative, to make exactly that happen. So there's no reason, and again, we know that pill marketing is definitely as assertive and aggressive as any other pharmaceutical marketing, so it kind of fits in.
Louise?
Well, yeah, I definitely had women in my study who weren't on the pill talk about doctors saying, why aren't you? It's so effective. And they did have that pressure. And I had one woman who really loved an IUD, but she was the only one. And I think that I just don't think they're offered to women as much here.
I guess from the non-hormonal perspective, there's two different types of IUDs. So one, the old type of copper IUDs, which tend to be out of fashion, and I guess that's because they have a worse side effect profile in terms of bleeding, not for everybody, but as a general rule. And also the IUDs that use hormones tend to have other benefits, particularly around menstrual bleeding, amongst other things. And so I guess that's why the hormonal IUDs are favoured more these days compared to the copper ones.
Mary?
I'm going to adopt Andrew Bolt's best practice and or not adopt it. I'm not going to comment because I don't know.
Thank you.
But I do want to make a final comment, if I can, to the UK visitor. I'm pleased to say that the study, the 4,500 study, that led to the conclusion about the relative safety of the pill or its beneficial effect on women's health. We have actually taken that and used that as a source in the takeaway booklet. And I just want to challenge your notion that there's been a lot of negativity tonight. I don't see that. I don't feel it. I think what we've tried to do is use this anniversary as a time to unpack a whole lot of really interesting, fascinating, not talked about angles and dimensions to this really, really important development around women's health, their sexuality and their reproductive rights. So I don't see it as negativity, but maybe you're a glass half full person and I'm a glass half empty or the reverse. Yeah. Maybe you should fill your glass before you go back to the UK.
And I'm sorry, but Mary's the boss, so I am going to give her the last word. Now, I know that some of you still have questions. I'm sure our panellists would be quite happy to take a couple of those one-on-one. Can I also invite you to drinks at Beer Deluxe, which is a bar in Federation Square? We will be handing out the pill. We won't. Don't quote me on that. That was a little joke. Can you please join me again in thanking our fabulous panellists? Put your hands together.